committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and tell us what you're doing to help our water situation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you for providing this opportunity for us farmers and different people in the ag community to talk about water. My name is Bill Gordon. I'm a fourth-generation farmer from Nobles County, the southwest corner, real close to Worthington. My father and mother, my wife works off the farm as a nurse. She keeps me on the farm. So with my... three children and one on the way, so interesting down there. Southwest Minnesota.
Bill, we need you to use that other mic, the microphone in the middle. Switch the microphones. That one we have problems with the time.
You want me just to sit here? Is it okay if I cover up the screen?
We'll cover up that. We'll cover up that
screen for you.
There. There we go.
Okay, you want me, would you like me to start over?
Yeah, start over again.
All right. Well,
we know you're from Worthington, but start over from there.
Okay. Say good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. Bill Gordon, southwest Minnesota farmer, fourth generation, live on a family farm down there, raise mostly corn and soybeans, and I serve as vice president of Minnesota Soybean Growers Association and also treasurer of Minnesota Ag Water Resource Coalition. We want to talk a little bit about the things that farmers are doing here today and the stewardship that is already being done in the land. A lot of times our message doesn't get out, and hopefully with some questions and any information I can give you that I can help you understand what we're doing. For stewardship perspective, our farm is managed better today than it has been in the past. With new technologies, new tillage practices, and mostly due to science and research, farmers today are doing more with less. We use less fertilizer than we ever have to raise more crop for the world. We used to raise, basically enough crop for us, our families, and maybe a neighbor. Now we raise, I think, around 125 people, every individual family farm. So a lot more with less, and the greater technology allows us to be better stewards of the land and use our equipment and our research to a better degree. In accepting the Nobel Prize in 1970, Dr. Norman Borlaug spoke, "A vast team consisting of thousands of scientists and millions of farmers." And today we still have a lot of farmers in the ground, but that population is decreasing percentage-wise to our urban brethren. We figure there's about 1% of active farmers today that their sole occupation and livelihood is from the farm. So that's 1% of the people in this country, in the United States, raising the majority of the food for the world. Conditions of farm improvements on farm management, increasing the understanding relationship between farm activity and water, enables us as farmers and leaders to deal with different issues. Most of you are aware of the TMDL issues and different water quality things that we deal with every day. And these regulations are are beneficial in some aspects and hindrance in others. And as a farmer and a coalition member, I'm here to basically address some of that stuff, and then I'm going to turn it over here to Warren in a second and talk about our coalition. A few years back, we decided as ag groups that we needed to get our voice heard a little bit more, people to understand what we're actually doing, the good things we're doing on the ground. And so we took and three starting organizations, Farm Bureau, Minnesota Corn, and Minnesota Soybeans, started the AgWire Coalition. In that, we opened up the gates and the doors for all Minnesota ag groups. We felt this is an agriculture issue, a Minnesota agriculture's issue, and I do believe, Warren, we have 15 now of our agriculture association groups serve as that board.
Okay, thanks, Bill. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Warren Formo. I'm the executive director of the Ag Coalition that Bill's referring to, and I think our primary role here today and what we want to do is help bring you into an ongoing conversation that's been going on within the ag community that has led to really continuous improvement. Bill talked about this generation of farmers, and I would emphasize that the generation of farmers that's working the land right now is the best this planet has ever seen. And a large part of that is because of research and education. And the Ag Water Resources Coalition was a new way of approaching research and education, but really was not a new and novel idea, in that the farm groups in Minnesota have been actively researching and supporting research and educating one another and educating producers and helping the industry improve for many, many, many years. But the coalition was formed essentially to turbocharge that activity and help the different groups be more coordinated across different commodities and different organizations and across geography, recognizing that Minnesota is a big place. We've got a lot of different kinds of agriculture, which means a lot of different needs for different farmers. The coalition was one of our primary activities early on was just to help farmers be more aware of what kind of pressures there are on the activities that they're doing, whether it's efforts to curtail drainage activities or the use of fertilizers, pesticides. Farmers need to be aware that those pressures exist and be able to develop a positive reaction or a positive defense when folks bring concerns to the agricultural community. And so one of the things that we've tried to do is educate farmers and involve them more in shaping the research that is going on all across the state, much of which is actually funded by Minnesota farmers through their checkoff programs. And the reason they're doing that is to help gather good data to help them make better decisions on their farms so they can become even more responsible stewards of the land. And there are a lot of examples you're going to hear from some of those researchers this afternoon. And so we're going to try to transition to them fairly quickly because they've got a lot of important information they want to share with you. But before we do that, I want to mention a couple of specific areas that the coalition is leading. And one is a project called Discovery Farms. And you may have heard of that. There's a couple of handouts in your packet that refer to Discovery Farms program. Discovery Farms is a concept that began internationally in the Netherlands quite a few years ago. A group of extension scientists, soil researchers from Wisconsin traveled to the Netherlands about 10 years ago and started a Discovery Farms program in Wisconsin back in shortly after the year 2000. About 3 years ago, as the coalition was being formed, we also had interest in gathering the same kind of data because in the past, agriculture's impacts on water quality have typically been derived by subtraction. We know some things that are going on in a watershed, point sources, factory pollution, and that type of thing. And we know what the ambient stream conditions are. And typically what was done was we would just subtract, and everything that was left was attributed to agriculture. And that spawned a conversation within farm groups and within farmers saying, we don't quite see it that way, because it was generating numbers that suggested that thousands and thousands of soil were being lost from every acre that was being farmed and nutrients commensurate with that. And so the idea of Discovery Farms is to actually gather field-level data on what's actually exiting a field in terms of water, sediment, and nutrients, and then figuring out, once we have that good field edge information, what are we going to do about it? And so our hope is that by gathering that data and sharing it with farmers themselves will be active participants in figuring out what the solutions are to those problems. And so it's been a program that's very well received. Right now we have four sites up and running in Minnesota. They're in Goodhue, Kandy, Ojai, Chisago, and Stearns County. And our hope is to eventually have a network of Discovery Farm sites that can characterize the conditions on a host of different farms representing different farming systems all across the state. Then on the education side, one event that I'd like to mention that I think is deserves considerable note is that the Ag Coalition, along with our partners at the Department of Agriculture, have hosted now for 2 years a nutrient management conference. And at that conference, we bring together farmers, crop advisors, other folks who are involved in the fertilizer industry, along with agency personnel, who all have an interest in helping move towards better nutrient management. And Mr. Gordon talked about the fact that our nutrient efficiency continues to get better. We're applying less for relative to the bushels that we're harvesting. And the place that farmers learn that information is at places like our nutrient management conference. So it's an event that we hope to continue to do along with the Department of Ag. It's a place where we can highlight all of the research that's being done by the University of Minnesota, the Department of Agriculture, and then our Discovery Farms program, as well as other work across the Midwest that can help Minnesota farmers manage better. And our hope is to continue to do that and not only inform farmers, but also inform others who have an interest in knowing the state of nutrient management in our on our farms in Minnesota. So with that, I turn it back to Mr. Gordon.
Thank you. I was going to have you look at this handout here quick and explain this a little bit. This is the one with the three we handed out with the numbers on. It says total losses, A1 to 07 to 11-24-09.
Let me clarify. You don't have that one. It's summarized in the handout you have.
Okay. Sorry.
Sorry. That was for Bill's information.
My information. On this, here, maybe I'll just get up and pass it around. On this this handout here, it actually shows hard numbers of what the losses are done. Told independent
Mr.
by
Chair?
University of Minnesota.
Senator Nelson?
Thank you. What handout is it exactly that we should be looking
no,
at?
No, we don't have that one yet. He's going to pass it around
okay.
to Carla to...
all right.
Oh, we can make copies of it.
Make copies of it.
We'll get copies of it. Quick.
Essentially, the handout that Mr. Gordon had is just a summary of the numbers that are highlighted in the handout that you have that describes the research that's going on at the Kandy-Ojai County Discovery Farm site, which is included in your packet.
And the reason I bring that up is when you look at that, it's actually not really a comparison, but independent study to look at stormwater runoff from the city of Wilmer and the volume and this high production, high nutrient wide field. And the comparison I want to bring up is not to look at the cities doing worse than farms were doing worse than the city. It's to look at the actual numbers that both are producing off of that ground is still below what the levels that we require for compliance. And actually, a lot of times, farm looks a lot better in certain aspects, and there's a couple that the city looks a little better. And that's I just wanted to bring that to your attention. In this summary, these numbers are a lot well below what we, as a coalition and a group, consider as a high enough number. The levels coming off these farms are good. And getting into that, why I brought that up is programs that we develop as a group, as a state, as Department of Ag, as a farmer. I'm out there looking to make the most amount of profit off with the least amount of inputs I can and do it the most environmentally friendly way I can, because tomorrow I'm going to farm, hopefully the year after that I'm going to farm, and I have two sons and a daughter and possibly a daughter or son on the way that I hope they'll take over agriculture in the future. And that land and those animals that I produce have to be better, healthier, and more abundant tomorrow to feed all of us than they did yesterday or my father's generation or my grandfather's generation. With that, we're talking in these handouts about programs necessarily about what farmers do for conservation, water quality. Alone in our couple thousand acre farm, we have about 300 to 400 acres of buffer strips and managed CRP land, conservation land, and Warren and I are talking the way in. We even have a piece of farm ground that we took out of production and made into a desilting basin for the city of Worthington. City of Worthington has a lake, Okabena, which flows down to the city water supply, and we are having too much rush of water coming across the golf course, which is after our field, and before the city of Worthington. We're having flooding. So my aunts and uncles and father donated the land to the county for this project, built a dam, put a three-pond distilling basin in, put CRP on either side of it, and the first pond was supposed to be cleaned out every 5 years for silt. That was what the study would have shown, that we would have had to clean out the first pond every 5 years. 10 years later, they're just getting to clean it out, and the only reason they want to clean it out is to actually see how much sediment they have in it. That shows that the buffer strips and the farming practices above this area is contributing less and less every year than what the models would show or the reason we did it in the first place. We've slowed the water down by using this facility, helped the flood in the golf course, helped flood in Lake Okabena and Worthington, improve water quality, and that was all done on a volunteer basis. So a lot of these things that we come up with as a group, Department of Ag, and you hear from the University of Minnesota too, is that you bring it up to a farmer, and it's the best thing to do, and it'll make us more profitable and it'll help the environment. We'll be your first ones to implement it. You don't have to ask us or even tell us. We'll probably be ahead of you due to the research.
Okay, very good. Any questions for the presenters? Senator Kelash.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is better from Mr. Formo or Mr. Gordon. This year we have had the heaviest snowfall on record, and while what we're talking about here is water flow in that, and one of my concerns, and has been for several years prior to even being in here, is that the amount of water that's being moved off the fields through the drain tile system and into the rivers is causing flooding downstream for cities like Granite Falls or that we're having more and more problems with. And I'm just wondering if any of your studies have looked into cooperating with the rest of the water management groups to try to figure out a way that we can effectively slow that down in years like this to where it's not going to be a problem downstream, and also have the ability to have them opened up and let you guys get in the field as early as possible when it's not an issue.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman. One of the things, and I mean misconceptions, is think of a piece of ground as a sponge. Okay. Mm-hmm. And after you fill that piece of ground up with water, it freezes solid. And where's the snow going to go? It's going to run off the top. The water's going to go somewhere. I mean, it's full of water. What a drainage tile does is, I can see a pattern tiled field. It actually creates air pockets. The water might look like it's going farther and increasing stream flow, but it actually is just more of a constant flow out of that field. Most of our drain tiles today are running right now, which tells you that water is moving through that soil, and it is creating holding capacity, air pockets in that soil to hold this actual snow. So one of Colin Peterson's, Representative Colin Peterson's ideas to stop the flooding up in the River Valley is actually pattern tiling the whole thing. And the reason is if you can take that area and create air pockets by having a constant flow of water instead of a rush, it actually doesn't increase stream flow. It actually reduces stream flow in most cases because it actually creates a pocket. It's more of a consistent flow throughout the year. But it's not an increase. You don't have this snow melt that rushes into the river and takes all the topsoil and all our nutrients with it. That's exactly the opposite of what farmers are trying to do. We're trying to create that air pockets to hold that water as long as we can, to not let it do the surge, because that's taking my topsoil, which I just spent $600 a ton fertilizer to put on. I'm not real hip on letting it go anywhere but my field and hopefully my production.
Okay. Mr. Chair, what I was looking at is, you know, it's great to have the flow, but when everything's got so much moisture in it and the amount of moisture, having a steady flow doesn't matter this year because the steady flow is still going to flood everything and this amount of acres. I'm just wondering if there's a way to hold it on the land for a little longer till stuff downstream clears out, so we're not flooding the cities or towns along the river as we move further south, move through the agriculture community. It's more about is this a viable way of looking at it, or is there openness in the farm community to try to handle it? You need to get in your fields, and that's your point of view. The guy downstream that's getting the water is got to put up sandbags. That's a little different point of view, but we're interrelated here, and what gets you in the field earlier causes more problems down later on, which the state sends relief to. So,
well, in that aspect, if you can still plug the tile, and I mean you can hold back water all you want on a tile flow, you stop that general flow, but then that water in that field is going to rise up to a certain level, and she's going to saturate that field. And right now, when we have these kind of snow years and this kind of moisture years, there's really nowhere for that water to go. It's either going to go into the ground or it's going to go downriver. And I totally agree. I don't want my brethren downriver to flood any more than I want somebody upriver to let that flood to me. If we plug the tiles, we fill the water, we fill that sponge, where's that water going to go? I mean, you'd have to build a physical dike along every river to stop that water, and that's what they're trying to do up in the northern plains. What our suggestion is if you find you want to reduce that flow, but there is an equilibrium of absorption and top runoff. And we can plug those tiles, and we can stop that flow for right now, but you're going to fill that basin up. But then how are we going to take care of the water? You're still going to have floodwaters, unfortunately. Now we have a full sponge up here, and when it really starts to belt and flood, you're going to have to open those up. Are we going to create more problem than if we had a try to maybe actually increase our tiling, our pattern tiling? I know it seems kind of an awkward comment, but the more tile, there's a lot of farms in this state that don't have drainage tile in them, a lot. Mm-hmm. If we could increase that tiling, you're not going to fix it in spring of 2011. But if you could increase tiling in 2012 and 2013, tile fields, well-drained fields, you actually increase that sponge in 2013, 14, and 15, you won't get those floodwaters because that ground is all winter has actually let the stream flow nice and smoothly. The water in the soil is gone. So when the snow melts, it absorbs the sponge, and there you sit with no floodwaters or a minor flood. So actually, to answer your question, help us increase regulation or decrease regulation so we can actually tile more ground, increase more of a sponge for our healthy Minnesota soils, and we could probably help accomplish that.
Mr. Formo?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Kielash, I would add that this area of the effects in a given watershed or at a given scale of drainage on hydrology is something that's a subject of considerable research right now, and you're going to hear from folks later on today who are better versed than I am in the hydrology. But I would also suggest that the conversations about drainage have become much more sophisticated than they were at one time, in that we are beginning to look at different types of drainage systems. We've got to look at not only the way systems are installed and when they were installed, what did we know? Again, getting back to the idea that the more we know, the better we can do. Research is showing that a lot of these older tile systems can be retrofitted to have positive effects both in terms of production and minimizing water quality problems. And so a lot of that work is being done, and farmers are aware of much of that. They're doing a lot of things to retrofit tile lines already to make them less impactful, and we just need to continue to gather more information and spread more information.
Thank you.
And gentlemen, I'll point out, too, some work that Dr. Bruce Stock is doing down in the Southwest Regional Research and Outreach Center, because I was on that advisory board and know about this, and that's something if we get down to that area on a field trip sometime, we'll go look at, because it answers it's a comprehensive study, Senator Kielash, on what you're looking at and how he's doing a huge study on this, and he's starting to get the information back now from the work he's doing. So Mr. Formo is correct, and we're doing a lot of this, but great questions. Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Kielash. They did a great job of answering the question, because actually the soil does have a lot more water-holding capabilities if it's well drained through tile. But I do want to bring up one issue, and I want you guys maybe to respond to this. The one area where I do see a concern is with the field drains. And is there some way that we as agriculture can eliminate the field drains that are that direct pipe into the ditch and replace that with more tile in the ground that doesn't have that direct connection? I was wondering if you could respond to that.
And I agree, Gordon? And actually most of the agriculture community agrees with you. Our problem ends up becoming a regulation factor. We go to get a permit for MNRCS or SWCD to update or fix our tile, and we want to get rid of that surface intake because we do see that as a point source pollutant. And we have restrictions. We follow Minnesota Department of Ag's restrictions on setbacks for pesticide and fertilizer application. The problem is, depending on which county you're in and how well-versed they are in the law, even though it's a law, some will let you move it, some won't. And if you do that, if you touch it, then you open yourself up to a whole bunch of other litigation and other problems. And so there's a lot of people that would get rid of it and expand fingers of tile, do more of a pattern tile field, which would be what we want. The misconception in the NRCS office in some of the places is, okay, now you're draining wetlands or something. And Senator Scoia, you know as well as I do, we're not, farmers aren't out there draining wetlands. We actually have a wetland increase due to farmers. We're trying to drain the stuff that needs to be drained and get rid of those surface intakes and increase our holding capacity of water so we can have more water available for our farm and also have less runoff. So the answer to your question is, I think you have a great, and you hear from some of these other guys, a great appreciation for getting rid of some of these problems, but we need the help of you guys to help us, you know, pass that on, say we need to make a better, healthier drainage system and healthier farms, and this is how we can help them do it.
Okay, it's a great segue into the next group. Thanks
Thank
a lot,
you.
Mr.
Thank you so
Gordon,
much for your time.
Mr. Formo, thanks for driving up. I appreciate it. Next, we'll have the Department of Agriculture. We have Dr. Adam Beer, and we had Bruce Montgomery to tell us what's going on with the Department of Ag. I know we've got some clean water resource funds in here, and gentlemen, and tell us what's going on there. Welcome, Greta, to the committee again.
Is this one not working?
We'll need to take off the cover there and make sure we have enough room there to see the slide when you're...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for asking us to come today to talk about water quality and water-related research that's going on through the Department of Agriculture. My name's Greta Gauthier, and I'm the Director of Government Relations. And I brought with me Dr. Adam Beer and Mr. Bruce Montgomery to talk more about our research that is ongoing. And I will turn it over to them. And with just a suggestion, Mr. Chairman, that perhaps at a later point you might also want to have the Board of Water and Soil Resources come in and show you some of the on-the-ground work they do once some of this important cutting-edge research is completed as well. And with that, I'll turn it over to our staff people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Adam Beer. I'm the Impaired Waters Technical Coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Today, I want to highlight some of our Clean Water Fund activities from the past biennium. And you have a handout that it covers pretty comprehensively. The handout there you have in your hand gives an overview of many of our projects.
It's this handout here, the Clean Water Fund.
Okay. And from that handout, I'm going to highlight a couple of the activities that we've initiated in the last couple of this past biennium. The first area I'd like to cover is some of our research activities. We use multiple advisory sources to guide our research priorities. There's sort of three levels, I would say, that we use to help guide and provide input on our research priorities. The first is we've been convening for the past two or three years now an ad hoc Impaired Waters Advisory Committee. This committee is largely made up of many of the groups that make up the Ag Water Resources Coalition that Mr. Formo is the executive director of. And we convene this group about two or three times a year and go over with them a lot of our projects, as well as get input from them on where we should go relative to our research and our RFPs and so forth. At another level, we also have a Clean Water Fund interagency research team. There are a number of teams that have been organized around the Clean Water Funds, and one of those is a research team that has representatives from each of the agencies. This is another area that we're able to get input from our sister agencies regarding our research priorities. And then lastly, at more of a local level, we have in-house, we have a water team with technical expertise in these areas to help kind of guide these priorities as well. This past fall, we released a request for proposals that was posted in September. The way these proposals are written, any organization, research entity, or individual may apply. We don't put any restrictions on who may apply. We do, though, have as one of our scoring criteria that the projects funded have to, we place a high value on projects that are going to provide direct knowledge or impart knowledge on the impaired waters program in the state. So they have to advance our understanding relative to impaired waters in the state. Our evaluation committee is comprised of a combination of the Clean Water Fund interagency team as well as non-agency members. So in this case, we had two producer representatives that were on our evaluation committee. So in all, we had six, and a third of the committee was made up of non-agency members. This past fall, we received 9 proposals totaling $2.4 million in requests, and we had $1.25 million available for contracts. And right now, we're currently undergoing the contract negotiation phase and hope to have these contracts and projects executed throughout this month and into April. Relative to our overarching goals relative to Clean Water Fund research, you know, there are three general areas that we're trying to address with this research. One is we're really trying to understand the underlying processes that affect water quality, that relationship between agricultural management practices and water quality. Secondly, we're also trying to evaluate the effectiveness of agricultural BMPs. There's a lot of, historically, a lot of research that has gone into BMPs. We're also trying to look into new technology, new best management practices, and also we're trying to address best management practice effectiveness at multiple scales as well. Particularly when we scale up to the watershed scale, there's still a lot of knowledge gaps regarding feedback mechanisms, time frames it takes to see a response, those sorts of things relative to the implementation of BMPs. And lastly, an area that we focused on is developing technologies to identify areas in the landscape where we can target BMP implementation. And one of these approaches that we've taken is to utilize LIDAR data or high-resolution topographic data to identify these hot spots in the landscape that we can implement these BMPs where they'll have the most impact. In terms of our most recent RFP, there were three areas we hoped, or three outcomes we anticipate having from the projects that we fund. One area is a comprehensive inventory of agricultural best management practices. We hope to have a handbook, if you will, of BMPs that tells us something about the current understanding and research regarding those practices. It'll also introduce perhaps new practices that are still sort of cutting edge, provide some understanding of the economics involved with practices, perhaps limitation and constraints to adoption and so forth, a real be-all and end-all. All-encompassing document relative to agricultural BMPs. A second area that was talked about earlier that we'd like to address with this most recent RFP is a better understanding of the relationship between artificial drainage, both surface and subsurface, and water quality and quantity. As we've heard from earlier testimony, there remains a considerable knowledge gap in some of these areas. And lastly, we also hope to identify an area for identifying priority management zones that can be applied to the state's 81 major watersheds. And this takes language from an approach that the Pollution Control Agency is currently using to address impaired waters in the state, coming up with a methodology that, again, related to our idea of targeting, identifying those hot spots in the landscape where we can have the greatest impact. I want to change gears a bit and go from the research and talk about some of our pilot projects and demonstration projects that we've engaged in over the last biennium. We heard a fair amount about Discovery Farms Minnesota, and as you've heard, this is really a farmer-led initiative to gather information about the water quality relationship between agricultural management practices and water quality and quantity across all different types of farms throughout Minnesota. You can see here from the pictures, this is very typical of what a typical monitoring site looks like at a discovery farm. What you see there in the foreground, that fiberglass structure there, is called a flume, and that is what we use to measure the water that comes off the adjacent field. And then that silver structure there houses all the monitoring computerized equipment. And we are monitoring 365 days a year, every drop of water that comes through that flume, including snowmelt, as you see in the picture before you. There's multiple partners in this project, and like we've heard, the coalition really is the lead on this effort. we're very proud to be a partner in this effort, and our role in this project is really to provide the monitoring expertise. So we've devoted technical staff that has a very good understanding of how to set up these monitoring structures, and they'll be working very closely with the local entities distributed throughout the state that will actually be collecting the sample. So we'll be coordinating those monitoring activities. We're also providing some equipment as our contribution to the program. This program, as was talked about, has been very successful in Wisconsin. It's been in existence there for more than a decade, and we're adopting a very similar structure to what Wisconsin has in terms of the steering committee and overall structure of the program. And again, we're monitoring 365 days a year, weather data, information on water quantity, quality, as well as the farm management practice information. Currently, we're in four locations, as was discussed. I would suspect in about a year, we hope to be in 8 to 10 locations in all throughout the state, with the next focus being on portions of the Minnesota River Basin and the Cedar River Basin. Closely related effort that's very complementary to Discovery Farms is a project that we initiated a little over a year ago now called the Root River Field to Stream Partnership. Again, this emphasizes this tenet of partnerships, particularly the public-private partnership. And you see at the bottom of the slide the four entities involved in this effort: the Minnesota Agricultural Water Resources Coalition, the Nature Conservancy, Monsanto, ourselves, and there are also the Fillmore County and Maurer County Soil Water Conservation Districts and a number of other local partners involved in this. This project really is designed to help Southeast Minnesota farmers and policymakers better understand the relationship between agricultural practices and water quality in that region. We focused on the Root River watershed that you see in the foreground in the map there. This is about a million-acre watershed in Southeast Minnesota. If you were to drive through the watershed, you'd encounter a very diverse landscape. Beginning in the western part of the watershed, it's a relatively flat landscape with sort of glacial till soils that require subsurface drainage to promote productivity. As you go to the east, you run into karst features like sinkholes and sinking streams and those sorts of features. As you move further to the east towards Rushford, you run into some of the bluffland characteristics. So it's a very diverse watershed. So to that end, we've selected three smaller watersheds that are representative of those three distinct geomorphic regions within that watershed to help us characterize the relationship between agriculture and water quality in that particular watershed. So we're monitoring at multiple scales. So we're monitoring not only at these sub-watershed scales, but also at the edge of field within these watersheds. And we're also employing a number of new tools and technology to complement the monitoring that we're doing in that watershed. You see here some of the images from the watershed and the producers that we're working with. Again, we're monitoring at two different scales, so very similar setup to what we're using in Discovery Farms with the edge of field setup and a flume where we're measuring or monitoring 365 days a year. That edge of field monitoring tells us something of we're trying to identify the different farm enterprises that are sort of endemic to the different regions within the Root River watershed, so we can really characterize that variability that exists across the watershed. We're also complementing that with the in-stream sub-watershed outlet monitoring. And the purpose of that monitoring is it tells us something about the linkages between the edge of field characteristics and the outlet. What happens between the edge of field and once that water reaches the outlet? It also sets us up for a framework to look at long-term trends. Should we impose any sort of changes in management over the long term, say 10 years or more? It gives us a way to track changes at the watershed outlet. This is a huge need relative to impaired waters. There's a significant gap that's been recognized nationally. In addition to the monitoring, we're doing a number of other assessments to help complement that monitoring data. We're working with Winona State University to assess the stream channel characteristics and look at the contributions from the in-channel, both in terms of nutrients as well as sediment. We're also doing a number of agronomic tests, including corn stalk testing that tells us something about nitrogen availability. We're also looking at the phosphorus contributions from both the edge of field as well as within the stream channels themselves. We're looking at using that LIDAR data, again, to identify those hot spots within a watershed utilizing terrain analysis. We're working with researchers that utilize sediment fingerprinting that allows us to track sources of soil loss across the watershed. And we're doing a number of other agronomic assessments, including traditional things like soil testing and manure testing and the like. In terms of where we're at today with this project, 2010 was our first monitoring year, and we had above average growing season rainfall as many places throughout the state experience. Through those watershed sites as well as the edge of field sites, we collected more than 400 water samples throughout that study. We've also collected a number of basal stock samples, soil samples, et cetera, throughout the study. We're currently conducting farm practice surveys. We have local staff in southeast Minnesota. They're working one-on-one. We have about 30 producers in total involved in this project, distributed across the three sub-watersheds, and we work very closely with them one-on-one, not only with the monitoring, but also with the surveys. And I just wanted to illustrate through the three pictures you see at the bottom of the slide, sort of illustrates what a snowmelt event looks like. And this could be this year's snowmelt event. We're anticipating perhaps next week this might occur. But a couple of things to notice here. The far left picture there shows what the site looked like on March 4th. Snowmelt was sort of initiated through the flume on March 11th. It only ran for a few hours. About 6 hours was how long that water actually ran through that flume. And then by March 15th, you know, you can see in the far right picture, almost all the snow has disappeared. So these are very episodic events. And the same is true of the rainfall events. These are very episodic, very short duration events that occur when we're monitoring these. It also makes it very challenging at times to capture these events. So it's just an illustration of the monitoring we're doing. It's also be translated to Discovery Farms in terms of the monitoring we're doing there as well. With that, I think I'll transfer to Mr. Montgomery, who will talk some about some of our groundwater activities.
Welcome, Mr. Montgomery.
Yeah.
Please announce your name for the tape.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, my name is Bruce Montgomery. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and have the good privilege of leading what's called our fertilizer management unit. I'm here in the St. Paul office. Thank you for having me as part of the celebration today about agriculture. I've got two different things I want to talk about that I think fit really well into the theme of this afternoon's discussion. And the first one is what's called AFREC, or the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council. I'm here speaking today on behalf of the council. Our relationship at the Department of Ag is that the council is farmer-led, and our role is to provide technical assistance and fiscal responsibilities in terms of the grant handling and providing any technical assistance, legal assistance that the council may need. The thing that really fits well in today's theme is the fact, again, that it's farmer-led. The purpose of this program is to advance soil fertility research, technology development, and also the educational component that goes along with that. This program was developed a number of years ago as part of the general feeling across all interest groups that Minnesota was falling further and further behind with our agricultural fertilizer recommendations and the technology advancements that go with that. I believe these feelings were felt across not only the university, but farm groups, the agencies, and industry as well. Because of these concerns, the 2005 legislature directed MDA to assemble what was called the Agricultural Nutrient Task Force, and the purpose of that task force was to determine the need for continued fertilizer research, how much it was anticipated that was going to cost, and the impact of a fee that might be imposed from that. Today's discussion is not to go into the history of the development of AFREC, which is the acronym we use for this, but rather to say that the agricultural groups were very adamant that if Minnesota wanted to maintain a strong presence and be a strong ag leader, that they themselves would have to make the required investments for the future. The mission is pretty simple: to fund research and education on agricultural fertility that is environmentally and economically sound. It's a pretty simple mission, but a pretty complicated to get there. And fortunately, we've got an extremely good council to work with. Inside your packet, you should have a little trifold that shows who the council members are, as well as a quick summary of some of the projects that were funded in 2010. Just a real quick overview of the financial impact of the fee that was eventually passed to help fund this program. We anticipated calculating out that this program would cost most of our Minnesota farmers that were in a corn and soybean rotation somewhere between 5 and 6 cents per acre per year. We believe that was a very good investment for the future, and that when we can resolve things like soybean rust deficiencies in soybean crops and many, many other soil fertility-related problems, and also improve the quality, crop quality in our crops, that this program could potentially save Minnesota farmers millions. I also want to emphasize again that there's 11 different farm groups that guide this program. It's a 12-member council. I emphasize that they make all the decisions regarding which projects are selected and what the priorities are going to be for that. And for me professionally, it's been one of the greatest experiences I've had in my 20 years here at the department. Very quickly, in just the last few years, some of the accomplishments that this group has made in partnership with MDA, three separate RFPs have been issued since the fall of 2007. Up to date, about $1.2 million has been allocated for either research or education. And currently, there's 24 soil fertility research programs that have either been past funded or are currently going on or will start this spring. Starting this fall, the council will have access to the full benefits of the 40 cents a ton. And we're anticipating that this fall there will be $800,000 available, and that will probably be the funding cycle every year from now forward. Just a couple of quick comments on what some of those impacts might be to Minnesota agriculture. First of all, and I think we're already seeing this to a great degree, but the research projects are highly reflective of what farmers and ag industry are asking for. I think the camaraderie between the university, ARS, the departments, the ag industry, the commodity groups, it's much, much more coordinated than it's ever been, as partially as a result of this council getting together. We anticipate to see plenty of modifications and updates to the University of Minnesota's soil fertility recommendations. One of the great things about these types of programs is that research conclusions can frequently be based on the appropriate number of years. Soil fertility research is slow. There's no getting around it. Our past funding through LCCMR and other funding cycles made it extraordinarily difficult to do the job right. We have spending authority up to 5 years, and we can also extend programs or ask researchers to come back and renew the projects. Some of the other outcomes, hopefully, that we're going to see a significant increase in people like Adam Burr that came through the University of Minnesota system in either BS, MS, PhD levels with soil fertility backgrounds. And also, there's been numerous educational events because of AFRAC. So lots of different things going on as a result of this program. We're very, very proud of it. We're just one small piece of it. It's really the farm commodity groups that are making this very, very successful. I just want to shift gears one more time, and that will be to talk about just a couple of other Clean Water Fund-related programs, and what's different about these from what Dr. Burr talked about is that these are going to be groundwater-related projects. As you know, in the legacy dollars, there was a percentage, I believe it was 8%, will be dedicated for groundwater protection. The general theme of our groundwater programs is really focused on helping local and having local partners. When we did this, we sat down with many, many soil and water districts and environmental health offices throughout the state, really tried to team up with them, identify some pilot projects that would be needed, practical solutions, hopefully some common goals. What our hopes were, if these programs would be successful, that we would be able to expand them into other parts of the state if additional funding would be available. I'm just going to give you a couple of quick examples. There's more information in your packet, but the first one we want to illustrate is the assistance that we're providing to Minnesota irrigators. From a groundwater perspective, we have a number of very delicate issues to deal with in the irrigated sand plains. These are very, very difficult landscapes to farm successfully without impacting. And one of the things that we wanted to do is team up with the Irrigators Association and with the other commodity groups and soil and water districts and really try to provide them with a series of programs, scheduling programs, climatic tools that they could use for irrigation scheduling, and a series of winter workshops to assist them. One of the things that we're noting in the groundwater networks is that nitrates are steadily increasing in the Central Sands area, particularly where we have the biggest database. Some of the other challenges that we're faced with is we do have a significant number of new irrigators over the last 5 years. Unfortunately, right now, there's no formal training currently available for them. So what we're trying to do is really try to plug that hole for the time being. There's a number of workshops and opportunities for these types of meetings with the growers to deal with both water scheduling, which is an important component on the irrigated agricultural landscape, and meeting the environmental needs as well. So as far as outcomes from this particular program, we expect to see a significant number of technical assistance and irrigation workshops going on. We're doing this through a contract with East Otter Tail County. They're very well plugged in with the irrigators across the state. We just held a workshop last week, as a matter of fact, and had 42 irrigators attend, which was really great, particularly when we're starting to get some of those new ones that haven't done scheduling before. Another thing that we're trying to do is really beef up the amount of evapotranspiration information that growers can get on a daily basis that they need to do irrigation scheduling successfully. Some new weather stations and ET hotlines will be going in again as a demonstration project for this year. Ironically, today was our irrigation forum where we were pulling in a number of irrigation groups, the university, extension, the DNR, Department of Health, PCA, and so forth, to really work together on trying to identify what are some of the future needs that irrigators are going to need to be successful in terms of education and technical assistance. And we hope that that provides us with considerable direction on the future. I have one other program. It's our groundwater monitoring program that's set up in the Central Sands. I think in the interest of time, maybe we should just open it up for questions. That handout is in your packet. But again, we're trying to team up with our local soil and water districts. In that particular case, there's 14 counties that we're working with to better understand the severity and magnitude of nitrates in groundwater. So with that, Mr. Chair, I guess we'd like to open it up for questions or whatever direction you'd like to go.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Any questions for the panel? Senator Scoy, go ahead.
Thank you. I don't have a question. I want to address, and help me with your last name again because I'm so terrible with names.
Montgomery and... Gauthier.
Gauthier.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Gauthier. I had a discussion with the previous testifiers about these field inlets, and I thought about just talking to you after the committee, but I think I want to say this publicly, so if anybody has any issues with this, they'll contact either you or I. You know, it occurs to me as I sit here that getting rid of these field inlets would be a good thing for the environment because it would slow the water down, it would clean the water up, and actually, if you did this properly, it would have no negative impact on the field drainage. I wonder if the commissioner could talk to the state conservationist and have him make a determination or have him look at whether this shouldn't be considered tile maintenance when farmers are filling out their O26 form. This should be considered a tile maintenance issue, and that would give them the opportunity, if they chose to do away with these field inlets and replace it with some subsurface tile. And it's hard for me to think that, I'm pretty sure this isn't a state problem. I'm sure it's a federal problem, but it's hard for me to think that if you have farmers that want to do this, that it's a good thing to do, that we can't figure out some way to get that accomplished. And as I think about it, I think calling it maintenance on your O26 would eliminate that regulatory concern that the testifier had.
Well, Senator Scoy, there's a drainage group that's part of the Bowser group.
Yeah, I see Bowser's here. So.
And Greg sits on that, too, as a drainage group. Maybe he could help with this a little bit, too, with your question, Senator.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, this really isn't a question. This is an issue that I've looked at for quite a while. We've got a fair amount of tiling on our farm, and we don't have any of these field inlets. But one of the things that gives tile a bad name in the world is that there's this field inlet, and people perceive it as a direct pipe into the river, right, which, you know, it potentially could be or it couldn't be. But I just listened to the previous testifier, and myself included, know that you can achieve the same drainage without having that. But the reason that people aren't changing over is because of a regulation with regard to the wetland laws. And I think if they called that changeover maintenance as opposed to an improvement, they would be able to accomplish that. And I think that the state conservationists can do that.
Okay, Ms. Coffier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Skoy, I'm sure the commissioner would be happy to sit down with you and discuss what is within the realm of the Department of Agriculture to do. So why don't we talk privately after this, and maybe we can set up a meeting and try to address those concerns.
Yeah, and if people out and about it, your Bowser's over there and farm groups are over here, yep, you see issues with that, you know, get a hold of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions?
Can I make one comment? Just in answer to your question, Senator, I do want to point out that as part of one of the clean water projects, there's a demonstration site put up in Clay County, completely subsurface tiled. It's a very uniform location, and Adam Burrs and Luke Stewie and Detroit Lakes out of our office are in charge of that. Quite a few of these systems do have subsurface technology where you can literally control the water table and manipulate it for output during different times of the year. But I think the general idea is have a high enough density of tile, shallow enough so you can get by without surface tile intakes. We're seeing quite a few conversions in the southern part of the state where wetlands aren't the issue. And I think growers really enjoy not having those intakes in. Reduces sediment. University researchers that are here later have done quite a bit of research on various tile design replacement systems and computer modeling and looking at changing the subsurface densities in lieu of surface tile intakes. So there's a lot of promise there.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I would encourage you to do if you're doing research on that is take a look at the Clearwater River Watershed District. There's a pretty extensive study done on tile outlets and water quality. It's all subsurface tile. They've done a real extensive sampling and water quality initiatives, and I think it's pretty encouraging stuff. So you might want to take a look at what they're doing up there.
Good points. And Mr. Montgomery, that got back to Senator Kielash's question earlier when we were talking about regulating tile and placing tile and all this. And it's a complicated situation, and I think we're making great improvements, and I'm very enthused to see your presentation, and I look forward to having you keep updating us on it. And also, one other question I had was just dealing with evapotranspiration. When you've got a field, for example, you have a field of corn growing, and you've got a lot of vegetation out there, and we're talking about water here. How much water with that field, let's say you've got a day in the 1st of August and it's hot and humid and warm and corn is really growing fast, and how much water is released back into the atmosphere from just the evapotranspiration process as a rough amount?
Mr. Chair, yeah, there's all kinds of what's called crop coefficient curves. These are the curves that put the water use and the crop growth cycle in relationship to whatever the climatic conditions are. So when we have climatic information like min-max temps, net solar radiation, wind speed, relative humidity, so forth, there's models that help us predict that, and then we ground truth it, and the experiment stations are very good at that type of thing. But in answer to your question, a hot day, fully mature corn, could be as potentially as high as a quarter of an inch per day. So when you're looking at an acre, 28,800 gallons per inch, yeah, and we're moving a lot of water. In fact, sure, one of the big challenges in most of our cropping systems, whether in coarse textured soils or our tile drain soils, you know, the big events in terms of drainage usually don't happen when the crop is out there. It's right. Off-season recharge that is really key. Most of our growers, their biggest challenge is just keeping up with the watering. and keeping the pumping rates up satisfactory.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. A great presentation. I really enjoyed it. Next, we've got continuing on a good panel here today. We have got Dr. Carl Rosen. I don't know where Julie went to, but are you related to Senator Julie? Carl? Oh.
I'm not related.
Okay. We have Dr. Satish Gupta from the University of Minnesota. Dr. Rosen's head of the Soils Department, I believe, and Satish Gupta has been doing a lot of work with the on Lake Pepin.
Yes.
Satish, I was unfortunate enough to follow two permitting bills yesterday, and we had a lot of discussion on Lake Pepin and how it's filling up with sediment, and we really want to know who's doing all that and who's to blame with all this. But I know not to follow a permitting bill in the agenda when I've got a good veterans bill to follow them. So anyway, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming over and talking to us, and tell us what's going on at the U of M and the work you're doing. We really appreciate it. I'll give your name and appreciate
you. Sure. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. My name's Carl Rosen. I'm department head in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate. I've been head since June, so it's been a short time. Prior to that, I've been at the university since 1983. I was an extension soil scientist there working in the area of nutrient management. But now I'm running the department, and what I'd like to do is give you some highlights of what we're doing related to water in our department. I'm going to give you just some of the highlights without a lot of detail, and hopefully there'll be enough time for Dr. Gupta to actually give you some of the research that he's doing in a little more comprehensive manner. So just a little bit of background about our department. We're one of 12 departments in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. And we have about 23 faculty in the department. About a third are directly involved with water quality research and education. I'd say the remainder of the faculty all have research that will impact water relationships, but a third are directly related with water research. We have a long history of conducting research and educational programs related to agricultural production practices and ways that we can improve our practice to minimize impacts on water quality and improve water quality over the years. If you take a look at the areas that we focus on, we used to be called the Department of Soil Science, so of course we focus on soil. We look at soil in relation to crops and natural vegetation in the state of Minnesota. We look at climate relationships, and we also look at water quality. However, you can't really look at these independently. You have to look at these in terms of how they are interrelated, how they integrate. Each one has an effect on the other, and so when we conduct our research, we look at these interrelationships to help us devise or improve land stewardship practices. Okay, so a couple of examples. One area that I'm familiar with is nutrient management, and you'll see that there's a lot of overlap with some of the previous presentations and what I'm going to be talking about today. But basically, we're responsible for developing nutrient management recommendations for crops in Minnesota. And as the previous speaker said, there it's a slow process. And as practices change, they need to be fine-tuned. It's an ongoing practice. What you see here is what we call best management practices for nitrogen. And you see that there's six bulletins. And it's based on different areas of the state. We recognize that there are different soils, there's different climates, depending on where you are in the state. And our best management practices and recommendations will vary accordingly. And that's why it takes a lot of research and a lot of time to have these done. And the funding provided by AFREC and other sources, grower sources, are very important for us to continue this work.
This was mentioned before. We're also involved with the Discovery Farm, Dr. John Moncrief. In fact, the data that you received earlier is from this particular monitoring area in the Willmar area. Basically, we're looking at field-scale research. A lot of our research previously has been on smaller plots, but we scale it up, and we're looking at monitoring these different practices to see what the effects are. We don't have any preconceived notions. We just want to see how these are impacting water. So it's a cooperation between university scientists, farmers, other agricultural professionals. We're trying to produce credible evidence and data to help direct how we should be changing our practices if they do need to be changed. So this particular study that Dr. Moncrief's involved with is in the Willmar area, and we're actually comparing stormwater with farm field drainage. And you can see here's an overview of the site there. Here's the Willmar area. We looked at some field where fertilizer was applied. There was a manured field, and then there's actually a control here. So we're looking at areas where nothing was applied, and we're comparing those. You have some of the data there. I'm not going to go into any details, but I will mention something at the end that I think you might be interested in learning more about this particular study in particular. Oh, yeah, and then we're monitoring these different areas for water quality. Another researcher in our department is actually located in at the Southwest Research and Outreach Center in Lamberton, and Dr. Strock is one of our drainage experts, and he has a number of different projects going on that might help answer some of the questions that were raised earlier. He has some controlled drainage studies going on, and depending on the situation, can have very positive impacts. We're also looking at various cropping systems and rotations that also have an effect on drainage. Ditch management is another area that he's working on where what he's trying to do is have water being retained more in the ditch to allow the soil to hold on to those nutrients a little bit more tightly and for a longer period of time. And then he's also looking at various wetlands, constructed wetlands, areas where water might be able to be stored, again, answering some of the questions that you have. But these are ongoing projects. We don't have all the answers, but these are things that we are working on. Just a couple of things, just showing you where the research that Dr. Strock is conducting down in the southwest part of the state. Informational pieces on about controlled drainage, because this is a way to control, looking at ways of controlling that water through different times of the year. And this, in some situations, may be the way to go. It may not work in all situations. You need to have relatively flat areas for it to work well. And Dr. Strock's working on that. One other project, totally different than what I've just talked about, is some of the fingerprinting that was mentioned earlier. Dr. Sadowski actually does a lot what's done on CSI, those types of things. He works a lot with DNA, trying to track where the bacteria come from various sources. And you can see in this particular slide, he's working with various animals in the natural animals, and he compares these with farm E. coli. So there's different fingerprinting going on there. So it's a very exciting area and contributing to our understanding of where some of the bacteria are coming into the water systems. One other project, this is one I happen to be involved with over the past few years. It was an LCCMR-funded project. Again, looking at irrigated cropping systems, these are very vulnerable soils. The title was Improving Water Quality on Irrigated Sands. The emphasis was on reducing nitrate leaching. We looked at some fairly novel products being produced, looking at controlled release fertilizers, some stabilized products, so to
help keep that nitrogen in the soil system as opposed to leaching through. And we've seen some fairly positive results with some of those products. We're also looking at different hybrids and varieties that are becoming more efficient in their use and utilization of nitrogen. Finally, and hopefully I didn't use all of your time, Satish, but sediment and phosphorus transport to Lake Pepin. This is a project that Dr. Gupta is working on. I'm not going to say any more. I just want him to go through that. But this is the one thing I wanted to mention, that the college, of which we're part of, is hosting a water symposium on May 6th. It's on the St. Paul campus. The title is Water and Agriculture in the 21st Century. There are six sessions. There's going to be a panel discussion, and it's intended for policymakers and those of the public that might be interested in the topic. So we hope that you'll be able to find time to attend that. With that, I'd leave the floor to Dr. Gupta.
Thank you, Dr. Rosen. Well, welcome, Dr. Gupta. I don't know how you got my cell phone number, but you called me at home here about in December and excited about the project you're doing. And I know how you got my cell number. So thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee members. I really appreciate your invitation to come over here. My name is Satish Gupta. I've been here in Minnesota since 72. I'm originally from India. Came here in the U.S., got my PhD at Utah State, and since 72 I have been here. And my background is very similar to Dr. Strzok, who is working at Lamberton. I did some work at Lamberton as well as Vesica. The recent project that we got, I think that will be very interesting to you, all of you members over here. It deals with the important issue of Lake Pepin's filling over there. And this is a project that I have been working on. It's funded by the Corn and Soybean Council, only part of it. And I thought it might be interesting to give you a little flavor of the project that we have and what we are finding and how difficult and somewhat you have to go back in the history and try to see what's going on. I think most of you have probably seen this diagram, and this shows the rate of sedimentation in Lake Pepin. And the recent rate as of 1996 is about 1.6 centimeter per year, and going back to 1500, it's about 0.2 centimeter. And I'm sure you are aware that this controversy has been going on in the public arena. And this work was done by Dr. Engston and his group at the St. Croix Lab, and they're suggesting that starting around 1830, when the European settlers came over here and started cultivating the land, and that's part of the reason it started going up, and then starting around 1910, that we have surface inlets and drainage system were installed. That's the reason we have a lot more sediment going in Lake Pepin. No, we have looked at this thing, this issue, and we have put a report together. That report is with Senator Magnus, and as well as with Jennifer over there. If you go back, 1850, the total population of the state of Minnesota was 6,077. So they could not have started producing that kind of sediment load in 1830. There were not enough people over there. Our agriculture at that time was very primitive. Most of the plows that we were using here, they were made out of wood. There was a little bit metal tip at the end of it, or they might have a scrap metal attached to it. And our soils, Webster, Nicollet, Clarion, they are very sticky soils. You cannot cultivate these soils very deep with that kind of plow system. And moreover, our landscape in the Minnesota River Basin is very, very flat. About 74% of the land is less than 6% slope. If you go back to the greater Blue Earth region, Blue Earth River Basin, 93% of the land is less than 6% slope, and about 54% of the sediments are coming from there. Now, we also, at that time, our cropping system was more diverse. We had mainly small grains like oats and barleys and so on, and that's a good cover crops, and you would not have a lot of sediment coming from those lands. Now, in terms of drainage, we had very limited drainage. The drainage enterprises were done in 1900, 1910, and at that time, drainage was limited. Limited area was benefiting over there. The drainage picked up between 1910 and 1920-25, and then again in 1930 we had a drought and a depression. That was the Dust Bowl era, so there was not much drainage installed. And then 1940 we had World War II, and many of the men who were laborers were gone to the military. Then even then, at that time, we have 3 to 5 year corn and corn rotation with small grains, oats and maddow and so on. So they could not be producing that kind of sediment that you are seeing in this graph. Now, 1950, the drainage picked up again because the prices of the corn and so on were going up, and most of the drainage was with the clay and that cement tiles. In 1970 came the plastic tile line, and even till about 1980, we did not put the plastic tile line because people were worried whether it can withstand the winter freeze of the soil and it would break and you have to do the replacement. So if you're thinking of Lake Pepin is a repository of many signals that are from three different watersheds, the Minnesota, the Mississippi, and St. Croix. And there are a lot of forces acting in this watershed, and there are some of them which are producing sediment. So you have to have sediment, and we know majority of that is coming from the Minnesota River Basin. And so there are three sources, which is the riverbanks, the fields, and the ravines. And we also know majority of them are from the riverbanks. Then the other thing is, how do they get to Lake Pepin? And that's where the sediment transport processes have come into play. Now, this was a project that was funded by the Corn and Soybean Councils. The idea behind this was you do a laser scan of the rivers in the Blue Earth County, since that's a major area that's producing sediment and contributing to Minnesota River. We had a scan in 2005 from the Blue Earth County, and we did it in 2009. And by overlaying one over the other, we know how much volume of the sediment came from those banks. And then you can convert those sediments into the mass, and then you can see what will be the amount of fine sediment going to Lake Pepin. So what we are finding here in this case is that for what we are measuring at the mouth of the Blue Earth River, 68% of the sediments are coming from the bottom one, Perch Creek and Blue Earth. These are the banks along those rivers. And then 70% to 86% of the sediment coming at the mouth of the Le Sueur River is from the banks of these Le Sueur River, Maple, and Big Cobb and Little Cobb. So majority of the sediments are coming from the banks of the river and not from the agricultural lands. Now, what's the mechanism that's causing it? And I'm going to show you in a series of these little slides. We just took a little piece of just clod of the soil from one of the banks, and we put it in a stationary water. It's 1 centimeter deep, and you can see it starts at 1020, and at 1040, it just disintegrates into a soupy mass. So it doesn't have very much strength when it comes in contact with water. And that's the reason the banks are slumping in the along the rivers of this greater Blue Earth region. Now, we know, so the one factor that's important is the strength of the soil when they become wet, and the other is we need water. Water is coming through seepage, and in this case, most of you know that we have perch water table. That's why we put the tile line, and sometimes that water moves towards the river, and when it gets to the bank of the river, then it just kind of oozes out and takes the bank down. Other thing that you'll see in this case, this is the Blue Earth River, and I have been monitoring this bank since 2001, and the seepage was going into the bank. And the water from the river went into the bank when the water level was high and it was too wet. It has too much weight. It didn't have enough strength. So when the water level went down, it slumped over there. Next year, it was taken out and the whole bank came down. So that's more of a natural process. Now, the banks are not only slumping at the base of the bank, but they are also in the top and the middle of the bank. This is, again, a bank on the Blue Earth River. You can see the mud flowing from near the top of this bank over there. This bank we found out this past year, and you can see a debris at the base of the bank. Now, this is along the Blue Earth River. Blue Earth River was the highest level at that time. Water level never goes to the top of this bank. So there are some other processes that are going on that we don't know. We went back, and it's the same bank that you're seeing. Now, we are seeing it from the backside. And we talked to the owner of this bank, and he said he could have walked to the tip of this bank 14 years ago when he bought the property. Now, this is, again, on the same day. I'm just showing you the close-up of that bank. Again, June 28th, we came back after 1 month. It was gone. There was some rain. There was some windy conditions. We don't know what happened. We think it's wetting and drying at that time, but there are some catastrophic events that are going on that are contributing sediment to the river. This is last September over there. This is on the Maple River. There's a bridge. They recently constructed $2.5 million. And you can see the peninsula over there. The river was meandering. We had 10 inches of rain, and most of this peninsula was taken, as well as a road. They had to put $150,000 a repair just to connect the bridge again with the road over there. This is the 1938 picture where the river was, the blue lines, and you can see the picture in the background. That's the last year's picture, and you can see how much of the banks have moved, 375 feet in one case and 240 feet in the other case. And again, this area that you see in here in the middle, it's kind of shrinking over time, and if we have too much rain sometime and if we have flooded condition, this river is going to go through here. It's going to take out tons of sediment. And that's part of the reason some of these sediments are coming into those rivers. So now we wanted to see there are two factors that's controlling it. One is the strength of the soil that's in the banks, and the other the availability of water. Now those two factors have not changed when the settlers came over here. So we start looking in the history of these, what happened previous to settlers came. This gentleman, Fanshawe, he was a well-known geologist of his time. And he came to Mankato September 22, 1835, and he goes to Blue Earth River, and he looks at the Blue Earth River and says this was a bold stream about 80 yards wide, loaded with mud of a bluish color, evidently the cause of St. Peter being turbid. St. Peter was a previous name to the Minnesota River. So even at that time, before very many people lived in the state of Minnesota, that we had the turbid condition of the Minnesota River, and that was because of the Blue Earth River. And there are several other travelers' log that shows the same thing. Now, this is 1904 and 1905. USGS had made some measurements in the Minnesota River, and they record over there that during the springtime we'll have turbidity as high as about 600 to 800 milligrams per liter. Now, that's quite a bit of sediment going in the river. Now, this is a 1937 picture, June 30th. And this is the first time any aerial pictures were taken in the state of Minnesota by the USDA. Now, you can see this is the Mississippi coming over here. This is the Pike Island close to Fort Snelling. This is the Minnesota River. And this is, again, muddy even at that time. And this 1937 was the Dust Bowl era at that time. We did not have very much rain coming during that period. This is the Blue Earth River over here. This is the Minnesota coming to Mankato. And you can see the Minnesota River gets muddier just when the Blue Earth River comes. And that's again in 1938 during the dry period. This is the Baltimore River coming to Blue Earth. And Blue Earth is already muddy at that time. Now, you must have seen this picture quite often. This is the St. Croix River. This is the Mississippi River after the Minnesota joins. And this was in 2004. And this is a picture that has caused a lot of problems to a lot of people, but if you go back, and I have other series of pictures in the report, July 1938, Mississippi River is muddier than the St. Croix River. And this was happening even at that time. This is a 1960 picture that was taken by DNR, and you can see at that time we did not have a plastic tie line, and even then a lot of sediments were coming in the Mississippi River through the Minnesota River. So we think it's not the production, it's not the agriculture. We think we have changed the transport system that is carrying more sediment to Lake Pepin and not so much a production system. There is some coming from the agriculture land, but if you think about this is the prior to 1850, if this is the Minnesota River Basin, and we have less basin storage, there's less water stored over there, but the river was quite meandering. Now our rivers are straight. We have a lot more precip now than we used to have. And then also, we got 5.3 million people living over here in the houses, the Mall of America, visiting their airport and I-494 strip. So we have a lot of impervious surfaces where the storm water is going to the river. And another thing that's very important, many of you may know the Lake Pepin started in St. Paul 11,000 years ago. And it has been filling up. And there's a delta that's moving downstream 10 meters every year. And because of the movement of delta, it's shrinking the lake. And that has a big implication when you take a core samples, try to see what the sedimentation rate is. The other important thing is the Army Corps of Engineers were authorized by the U.S. Congress to dredge the Minnesota River to 4-foot deep channel. And that was 1892. Since 1892 to 1943, they have been dredging every year at the mouth of the Minnesota River because a sandbar would develop over there. Now, Pike Island is more of a big sandbar because the Mississippi is coming at a very fast speed and Minnesota is slow, so some of the heavy sediments settle. And even they are doing this even right now, every year from river mile 0 to 1.1, they have been dredging this river. So before, at that time, only 18 inches of water would flow over the sandbar, and behind that you have a 6-foot deep channel. So if we think it's this sandbar, if you don't take the sandbar out, that's part of the reason some of the sediments were settling in the basin and never got to Lake Pepin. Now in 1943, Cargill got a contract from the U.S. Navy to build ocean-going tankers and towboats. And they built 18 of those tankers and 4 of those towboats, and here is one of those examples. And this was done at Port Savage. As part of the contract, they had to dredge the Minnesota River 9-foot depth and also widen the river. So once you dredge it, you're making sure the water does not interact with the floodplains and sediment don't settle in the floodplains and they're being taken down to the river. We have also straightened the river. Now, this is the Minnesota River near Fort Snelling. You can see in 1957, it's kind of meandering, but 1980, it's straightened out over here. We dredge it, and we're kind of helping the sediment and the water go down to Lake Pepin. We know the Minnesota River is coming through a flat valley. There's a 6-inch drop every mile from Mankato to Fort Snelling. So because it's a flat region, there are a lot of sediment settling. We have, between 2000 and 2008, 119,000 tons of sediment was settling in that valley. And this is in addition to the Army Corps of Engineers is dredging 20,000 tons, and then about 60 to 100,000 tons of the sediments are coming from the banks of the Minnesota River between Mankato and Fort Snelling. So there are a lot of settling going on at the present time, and you go back and think in the previous time when the river was meandering and we had not channeled it, there was even more settling over there, and that's part of the reason some of the sediments are not moving, were not moving down to Lake Pepin. Now, we have also built the levees. This is a levee on Mankato. We are forcing the water and the sediment to go downstream. There's a levee at Henderson. There's a levee at St. Paul. There's a levee on Blue Earth River. There's a levee on Hastings. So all of that levee is forcing the water and the sediment go downstream and not interact with the floodplains. As I mentioned, that we have a lot more houses and parking lots and roads and so on. The 7 metro county area, 30% of the land is impervious to different degrees. So all the storm water is just going through that land and going into the rivers in the Minnesota River. We also have a lot more precip in recent years at every probability, 1 out of 100 years, 2 out of 100 years, and so on. So we got a lot more rain coming here, and that's also causing the water to move and carry some of the sediment. Now, if you have, because of those, we have levee construction, we have precip, we have dredging, we have straightening, and we're making sure all the water moves. So we have a lot more flow in recent years than we have flow in the previous times before the people came over here. Now, this is my last one slide. I mentioned about the delta. Now, if you think about the present-day lake and think about that's a big tub over here, and you have the same amount of sediment coming at time 1, time 2, and time 3, so when you have a sediment coming and some of the heavy sediments are settling at the point where the delta is and some of the fine sediments are going to form a very thin layer. You come back and same amount, now you have shrunk the volume of this lake. Now again, some of the fine heavy sediments settle over here. Now you're going to have a little thicker layer of the fine sediment because you have a less volume over there. Time 3, you have a lot more thickness over here because there is even more shrinkage of the volume. Now, if you go and put a little pipe over here and take a sediment core, and you say earlier sediments were lower rates of sedimentation and recent rates are very high, that is an artifact of the shrinkage of the volume of the lake, too. So we don't know to what degree that's happening in Lake Pepin. If we want to know the natural rates, we need to take this rate and add all the rates that are settled over here and do the same thing, this rate and all the rates and so on. So we need to compare that. So there are a lot of questions that we don't know as of this stage. We don't think agriculture is contributing a lot of sediment. We think it's natural forces that are causing the sediment to move from the banks of the river. These rivers have been muddy before the people came over here. They're going to remain muddy unless you got tons of money. okay? And there are natural forces that are causing these banks. We have changed the delivery system. There's a more precip happening. There are a lot more increased impervious surfaces. There is some sediments coming through those surface inlets, and corn and soybean councils have funded some projects that we're trying to see how you can take them out, and what quantity of water might be moving through those surface inlets. And it needs more research. I think that was a message I want to give you, that Lake Pepin is a problem. We need to think about it. But I'm not sure agriculture is a culprit. I think there are natural forces causing this thing. And we have changed the river system that's helping transport some of these sediments. With that, I thank you your attention. I appreciate the opportunity to come over here. And I'm open to questions if you have time.
Okay. Fascinating, gentlemen. Quite some presentations we've had today. I have to tell you, this is one of the best committees, ag committee meetings I've been involved in. Really, really good, and I really appreciate the story you're telling us. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I know we've got work to do. All of us admit that, but I wasn't going to sit here the other day and let agriculture be painted in the light it was and say we aren't doing anything, and when I know better. And I'm helping pay for some of it.
Yes,
too,
sure.
As a farmer. So I really appreciate it. Any questions for Drs. Gupta and Rosen? Any parting comments? Dr. Rosen, you have anything?
Well, I just want to, again, thank the Mr. Chairman and the committee for the opportunity to be here. As you mentioned, we are conducting research. It's ongoing research, and it's I think it's going to be beneficial for both agriculture and the environment.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Next meeting we'll have, we'll call that a biomass day. We've got some bills and some other presentations and talk about biomass. And we will have a bill on clean water coming up either Thursday or Monday. As we look at continuing this kind of work and using legacy monies and others that we can access to continue this work. With that, members, we'll adjourn for today. Thank you very much.